I'm Professor Steve Fonash at Penn State University.
Welcome to Engineering Science 216, Characterization and Testing of Nanotechnology Structures and Materials. The course objective is stated on this slide. The course is intended to provide an overview of the characterization and of the testing techniques used for materials and structures which involve the nanoscale. So that's our overall course objective through all the lectures of the course. We need to think about what we mean by characterization and what we mean by testing. Here's the definition. Here are the definitions that we'll be using in this course. We're going to use characterization to mean the determining, describing, and defining of a material or a structure in terms of features such as chemical composition, bonding, architecture, and topology. So we'll use that same definition of characterization at all different scales, and of course including the nanoscale. Testing we'll be using to mean the evaluation of the ability of a material or structure to perform a specified function. So that'll be our definition of testing throughout the course. So the outline for lecture one is as follows. We'll talk about characterizing at our size scale. We'll talk about the use of the five senses. And those, of course, are touching, seeing, smelling, tasting, and hearing. But we'll reduce those five senses to four. We'll talk about touching. We'll talk about seeing. We'll combine tasting and smelling into chemical detection. And then we'll talk about hearing, and then we'll move to the nanoscale in lecture one and in our final slides of this lecture, talking about an introduction to touching, seeing, chemically detecting, and hearing at the nanoscale. So we'll begin in our size range and then move finally at the end of the lecture to the nanoscale. So how do we characterize? How do we humans characterize at our size scale? Well, at any size scale, we characterize things through our senses. And there are five senses, as I mentioned, touch, sight, smell, taste, and hearing. As I also said, we're going to lump smell and taste into one category, chemical detection. We have two ways in our bodies to do chemical detection. Let's just lump them together for the purposes of our discussions into chemical detection. Sometimes to characterize things, we need assistance from machines and electronics. Even in our size range, we sometimes need help to characterize things. So, for example, some of us need hearing aids to hear better, and some of us need eyeglasses to see better. So it's not surprising that at the nanoscale, we really need all kinds of machines and all kinds of electronics to help us touch, see, smell, taste, and hear at that scale. So we have these five senses, which we said we're going to lump into four: touch, sight, chemical detection, and hearing. At the nanoscale, as we said, we're always going to need help from machines and electronics. At our size scale, sometimes we need some help, like hearing aids and eyeglasses, as we said. But at the nanoscale, we're always going to need help to be able to characterize at that scale. And so there has resulted from this need for help at the nanoscale, there has resulted a myriad of nanoscale characterization approaches. They have all kinds of interesting names, which you'll come to know. Things such as scanning electron microscopy, Auger electron spectroscopy, scanning tunneling microscopy, and they go on and on and on. You'll come to know these terms. We'll be talking about them in the next couple of lectures. And as we go through the course, you'll learn more about various members of this myriad of characterization techniques. You'll learn more about them. You'll see how they're used. We'll pick particular examples to go into more depth about them, and we'll go into more depth about their application at the nanoscale. But there's a whole bunch of these different nanotechnology characterization approaches. So let's go back to the five senses and their use at our size scale. What is touching? It's a very basic idea, but let's make sure we're all thinking about the same thing. Touching is physically feeling something through your skin or fingers. Another definition is the sense that tells you what something feels like when putting your skin or fingers on it. Still another definition, one which I think is very general and appropriate to this course, is using tactile, that is physical interaction sensing, to detect a presence. So we're going to use this definition in this course. This is what we're going to mean by touching. And it's a good definition for all size scales, ours and even down at the nanoscale. So touching is obtaining information via tactile sensing, that is from physical interaction with the environment. I find this very interesting that a group of Swedish scientists has recently explored how sensitive are our fingers. And they found recently that humans can detect nanoscale wrinkles. In other words, wrinkles that are of the size of the nanoscale, with their fingers. So you have what you think is a smooth surface, but with your fingers you can actually pick up nanoscale wrinkles. Apparently the humans can pick up nanoscale features which are of some extent, not just individual little tiny nano bumps, but I'm amazed at how sensitive our sense of touch is. So we use touching a lot. We use it on our computer screens, obviously. We use it to detect things. We actually use it to see also. An excellent example of that is blind people using Braille. And they can actually, with the sense of touch, they can actually get a mental picture of words and of concepts. So touching is very powerful for detection, manipulation, and for actually getting an image. So what about seeing? Let's pursue the definition of that too. It's to perceive with the eyes, to look at is a definition. A more scientific definition is sensors in the retina of the eye responding to photons. Respond to these photons by sending a signal to the brain, triggering a conscious response. Of course, photons, as we know, are the quantum, the packet of energy of electromagnetic radiation, and our eyes respond to the part of the electromagnetic spectrum that we call visible light. So our eyes respond to photons that are the energy packets of visible light. So how good are our eyes? We talked a minute ago how good our touch is. Well, our eyes are very good also. They can detect a single photon, a single one of these quantum packets of energy. However, there are neural filters that allow a signal to pass to the brain only when there's about five or more photons that arrive within 100 milliseconds. And so there's a filtering mechanism there so that the brain doesn't get overloaded with a lot of noise. But the bottom line is our eyes are extremely sensitive, as we just learned is our sense of touch. The definition of seeing we will use in this course is a very general one. We're going to say that it is using the eye, perhaps with machines and electronics, to convert physical information into an image in the human brain. So that's the definition we're going to use for seeing. With that definition, we're going to have lots of different ways of seeing. And at our size scale, you know, miles, inches, meters, that sort of thing, we generally just use photons, light, to see. But at the nanoscale, we're going to use a lot of different approaches to seeing. And light will be just one of them, actually, generally speaking, a minor approach to seeing at the nanoscale. And as we said, when we think about light, we have to remember that it has particle properties as well as wave properties. We have to talk about the wavelength of light. We have to talk about how it spreads when it comes up to features, that is, diffracts or scatters. But we also have to talk about the fact that it exists as packets, as these photons. And some folks find this idea that light is both a particle and a wave as disconcerting. They're in very, very good company. Einstein once said that it seems as though we must use sometimes one theory and sometimes the other. He was referring to the fact that sometimes we have to think of light as a packet, sometimes we have to think of it as a wave. While at times we may use either, we are faced with a new kind of difficulty. We have two contradictory pictures of reality. Separately, neither of them fully explains the phenomenon of light, but together they do. So we have to accept that light has both particle properties, photons, and wave properties. So the photons that we use in our size scale with our eyes are the photons in, as I said earlier, what's called the visible light part of the spectrum. So as you can see here, the electromagnetic spectrum is quite broad. It goes from very, very high frequencies to much lower frequencies. These are not frequencies, these are wavelengths. So if it's a high frequency, it's a very, very short wavelength. So this is a very short wavelength, and this is a very long wavelength. As you know, C equals lambda times nu. That's the speed of light. So if it's a high frequency, it's a short wavelength. And you see that in here. Very high frequency, very high energy, then a very short wavelength. And of course, frequency is related to the energy in the photon packet. So high frequency, short wavelength, high frequency, large energy. Well, the light only responds to this part, the eye only responds to that part of the spectrum, a very small piece, and the eye sees the photons. The brain sees the photons in that part of the spectrum as ranging from red all the way through to violet and then ultraviolet. So we have gamma rays, X-rays, ultraviolet, the visible, this tiny part here, infrared, which of course feels like heat, radar, FM, TV, and shortwave, and AM radio. Our eye only responds to these photons. Here's another way of looking at the electromagnetic spectrum in a tabular representation, as you see here. And it's just this little portion here that our eye responds to. You can see from this tabular version that the wavelengths of that our eye responds to are in the nanometer range, but usually people think about the nanoscale as being 100 nanometers or smaller. So this is just a little bit larger than the nano range, the wavelength. These are the frequencies, and of course, using that formula that we just had there a minute ago, these are the energies of the photons. They are in the 1.7 to 3.3 electron volt range. And then you see the frequencies and the wavelengths and the energies in the surrounding regions of the electromagnetic spectrum. Okay, we can detect everything with our eyes at our regular scale, you know, cars, trains, people. With the help of machines like telescopes, we can actually use our eyes to see astronomical features. With the help of machines called microscopes, we can see things that are in the micron size. So we can actually see bacteria. So we can actually stretch to, with telescopes to see astronomical features. We can go down to microns with microscopes, all using our eyes. The wave properties of light limit how useful a microscope is. We have these microscopes, they can allow us to see small objects, but because our eye can only see certain photons, therefore can only react to certain wavelengths, we have a limitation. If we go back and take a look at this table, we can see that 400 nanometers, I'm going to round off 390 nanometers, 400 nanometers is the smallest wavelength that our eye can pick up. Well, that's going to limit the smallest feature that we can see, because we if something's too small, the light won't be able to, the light will diffract. It'll come up to this feature and then diffract. And so we'll think the feature is actually that size. So if the wavelength of the light is of the order of or smaller than the feature size, then we can still see it. So if 400 is the smallest wavelength, then the smallest feature we can possibly see would be something like 400 nanometers in size. 400 nanometers is 0.4 microns. Well, if you do a more detailed analysis of it, it turns out that it's about 2 microns, or 200 nanometers, is the smallest feature you can see. And this was first realized almost 150 years ago. So yes, the microscope can allow us to see down at very small feature sizes, but only down to about the micron size. To get to the nanoscale, to get down to things that are 100 nanometers or smaller, where we can't use the microscope because of this diffraction limitation. And because of the wavelengths our eye can respond to, and because of the photons our eyes can respond to. When it comes to chemical detection now, we do a good job at our size scale. We use tasting and we use smelling. And we're actually, with these senses, detecting chemicals in the air or on the food. And tasting and smelling have different sources. Smelling has these features in the nose, and tasting has these features in the throat to get information to the brain to identify, detect and identify chemicals in the environment. We, with these senses, chemically characterize or detect what's going on. The detection limit of human tasting and smelling depends on factors such as a molecule's shape, its polarity, that means whether it has a positive end or a negative end, partial charges, that is any kind of charged distribution, and molecular mass. We can detect the presence of molecules in parts per billion, but it depends on the particular molecule and all these factors I just enumerated. So we can detect, but recognition is not as good. It's one thing to detect it's something wrong in the environment. It's another thing to realize what the chemical is. So we saw what the limit is for touching. Pretty amazing. We saw what the limit is for seeing, very much limited by the photons our eye can pick up. And here we see a limit on chemical detection also with our eyes. What about hearing? Hearing is sensors in the ear responding to changes in air pressure. And so when the ear picks up these changes in air pressure, it sends signals to the brain, which triggers a conscious response. So here, hearing is the process of receiving sounds. Specifically, it's the sense by which noises and tones are received by the brain as stimuli. The range of frequencies that can be picked up by the human ear is usually noted as being from 20 to 20,000 hertz. So we saw that there's a range of wavelengths or frequencies that the eye can respond to. There's a size limit that the touch can respond to. And here with hearing, we see that there's a limit, also a frequency range that we can respond to. We also, by the way, saw that our chemical detection was limited in a similar way. And so the ear is the organ that does this hearing detection, picks up these waves in the air, coming these perturbations in the density coming to the ear, and these are waves coming, but as we saw with electromagnetic phenomena, acoustic phenomena also are waves, but also have energy packets. And in the case of acoustic phenomena, which we think of as density waves, pressure waves, in the case of acoustic phenomena, that packet, the particle packet, is called a phonon. So our ears pick up the wave properties, but also respond, obviously, to the phonons. So the phonons are the acoustic analog of photons for electromagnetics. And there's an acoustic spectrum. We saw the electromagnetic spectrum. Here's the acoustic spectrum. We see that this is the range that humans can pick up. This range of lower frequencies, analogous to the electromagnetic spectrum, is called infrasound. This range of higher frequencies, analogous to the electromagnetic spectrum, is called ultrasound. And then there is higher frequencies, sometimes called super ultrasound. Up in this range. Obviously, we use this range to detect what's going on in our miles, inches, feet kind of size regime. This is where we pick up information. But animals can go into the ultrasound. Some animals can. For example, dogs can hear up in this range. And we use ultrasound. We use it to drive chemical reactions. We use it for cleaning, ultrasonic cleaning. It's often used in a nanofabrication facility to clean instruments and glassware. And also the medical profession uses ultrasound for imaging. They use acoustic waves, ultrasound, to actually image. We know that's a very powerful imaging technique. We know it's made great advances in patient care, for everything from checking on the development of an in utero infant to studying heart function. Then in the super ultrasound region, acoustics are used for non-destructive evaluation, or this is also called NDT, non-destructive testing. So with acoustics, you can look to see if there's a crack in an airplane wing or things of that sort. So the part of the acoustic range that we can hear, the part of the acoustic spectrum we can hear is called the acoustic range. So there's a little bit of terminology confusion there. The ranges outside the acoustic range require machines and electronics for us to detect them. We can't, a dog can get up in here, but we can't get anywhere up in here. We certainly can't get down here. We certainly can't get up here. We can detect things. We can detect ultrasound. We can see the picture of that infant in utero, but that ultrasound has to be converted into an image that our brain can respond to, and it's converted into a visual image. So we need lots of machines and electronics to use acoustics in these other ranges other than this range. So what about the nanoscale? How do we use touching at the nanoscale? Well, we already saw that we can get down close to the nanoscale with our fingers, so we're going to have to see how we can do even better. We saw that when it comes to seeing, that we definitely have a very clear barrier caused by the diffraction limit, the same barrier that we saw in photolithography. And chemical detecting, we can do pretty good, but again, we can't get down to finding, we can only get parts per billion, and at the nanoscale, we might want to actually see individual molecules, and we might want to really see things in a very detailed manner, so we're going to have to think about work on that. And hearing at the nanoscale, we definitely only have a certain range that we can respond to. So it's clear we're going to need a lot of clever help from machines. And you know I'm using the word machine in a very general way. I call a microscope a machine. And we're going to need help from electronics to convert images or convert things into images. So we're going to take a look at touching at the nanoscale in an introductory fashion, and this slide shows how we can do touching at the nanoscale. We can make a probe. This is a probe here, and we can use that probe on a surface, just like a finger going across a surface. But we're going to make the capabilities of that probe much better than those of a finger. We're going to create a probe which essentially ends on just a couple atoms. And so you're going to have an interaction of this probe, but it just ends on a couple atoms with the surface. So in principle, you can actually pick up the interaction between an atom and at the end of the probe and atoms that constitute the surface. So you may ask the question, how do we get such probes? Well, it's sort of a circular sort of thing. We learned how to make very fine probes when we started to get into the nanoscale. We started to make very, very fine things. We started to make these probes, and then we could make them even better as we got into the nanoscale. And so we could see what we're doing, and so we could do more in the nanoscale because we could see what we're doing. I'm generalizing the word see here because you know and I know we can't see things at this scale, but we can see them by touch, as I will describe in a minute, just like you can see by touch with Braille. So this is kind of like generalized Braille. So it's a circle where we learned how to make very fine structures, such very fine tips that came down to just a couple atoms, as we learned how to practice at the nanoscale. And when we made these tips, we learned how to practice better at the nanoscale because we could see what we were doing. And so it's kind of a circular development. In fact, these tips can be carbon nanotubes. They can be that fine. So you can see now we can make extremely fine tips. And this tip then can sense the surface. There are many ways to sense the surface. There's the forces between the atoms of the tip and the atoms of the surface. Forces at a very, very basic level. Interatomic forces, van der Waals forces, can be electrostatic forces, very fundamental forces between these atoms and these atoms here. And we can then set up a with some very nice engineering, we can set up a tip that detects these forces. And if we want to actually convert that into a picture of the surface, we can use some electronics to actually convert the force into a picture. So when the force is strong, we know we must be close to an atom, like here. And when the force is weaker, we know we must be further away from an atom. So we can actually, with the help of some computer engineers, software folks, we can actually develop a picture that our eye can respond to. So we've used electronics and machines to be able to see, and I'll put quotes around that word see, at the nanoscale. We're going to see a lot of probe techniques. Once you see how we can make these fine structures, and once you see how we can detect all sorts of forces here, we can detect currents. We don't have to look just at forces. We can detect currents. We can do lots of interactions between the probe and the surface, lots of ways of seeing and learning about the surface. We can see with the photons. We can do that if we have very small wavelengths. Wavelengths of the order are smaller than the feature we're trying to see. So if you can do that, you can therefore see at the nanoscale. Remember we said the smallest feature is that the eye can pick up. The shortest wavelength that the eye can detect is about 400 nanometers. So that means that you roughly can see something that's 400 nanometers in size or larger. But we said that with a more detailed examination of that, it's about 200 nanometers. That's our limit. That's how small we can see with just photons, with just light. We're going to need help seeing things smaller than that because we're limited to those photons, to those wavelengths, because of our eye. If we use a microscope, ultimately our eye has to respond to the light. So if we're using that kind of light that our eye has to respond to, we're limited to the wavelength of the light, which limits the size of the feature we can see. There are very clever ways to get around this, and we can get around it with photons. We can get around it with photons that our eye responds to, or close to the photons our eye responds to. We can use, let's say, photons from the visible range to excite molecules to fluoresce. So as you know, molecules have energy levels. And if you promote an electron up to a higher energy level with some light coming in, let's say this is light that your eye can respond to, this molecule is promoted up, and then the electron relaxes back down, giving off some specific color that is characteristic of this energy difference. And therefore, you see that color coming from certain places, then you know you have these molecules here. So you can actually see things that are very close together, very, very small, but you're seeing them with this fluorescence phenomenon. The relaxation of an excited state back down, emitting a photon, and that photon being one that, that the eye can respond to. So that's such a clever approach that it was actually merited a Nobel Prize last year. It was awarded for the development of super-resolved fluorescence microscopy, which brings optical microscopy into the nano dimension. It's pretty amazing, very, very creative. In other words, this microscope, using the photons that our eye responds to, can actually be used with this technique, used to see molecules and the positions of molecules by using fluorescence. We can also use electrons to see at the nanoscale. photons are particles, why not use things that we really think are particles? I mean, photons are particles, but what should I say? Things that we're comfortable thinking of as particles, that is, electrons. Why not use those for imaging? Well, as you know, electrons have a wavelength, so we have to worry about the diffraction limit. It's called a de Broglie wavelength, and so there is a wavelength associated with the electrons. That wavelength is very, very small, however, compared to optical wavelengths. We can compute that wavelength, and it's an extremely small wavelength, which means that we can see features that are extremely small. This is going to be a very, very small number, so this is going to be a very, very small number. So we can see things that are extremely small if we use electrons in a beam, and we think about their wavelength because we're in the 21st century, so we, as demanded by 21st century technology, we have to realize that electrons have a wave, the de Broglie wavelength. We have to realize they have a diffraction limit, but it's very, very small if we do the calculation. So we can actually use an electron microscope to shoot the electrons down, and then the wavelength is so small that we won't have a diffraction limit problem, generally speaking, unless we have a very, very, very small feature. And so we can shoot an electron beam down. We can have a very, very small feature. The wavelength will not have a diffraction problem. And we can collect the electrons and then turn those electrons into an image that our eye can look at. So this is just kind of using electrons. And again, we go out and get that person who was our computer programmer, and they convert that electron current coming in into a picture. So here we see a picture of a feature on a surface that has been taken by electron microscopy. It's been taken by scanning electron microscopy. Scanning means that you move the beam back and forth so that you can generate this picture. And we can see at the nanoscale with ions. So let's see, we learned that we can touch at the nanoscale with these probes, and we've learned that we can see at the nanoscale with photons, with that very clever fluorescence microscopy. We've learned we can see at the nanoscale with electrons because they have such a short de Broglie wavelength. And we can see very well at the nanoscale with ions because the de Broglie wavelength of ions is even smaller than the de Broglie wavelength of an electron. The higher the mass, the smaller the de Broglie wavelength. So we can use ions to create a picture. So the ions coming off of something can be converted, again with our friend the computer programmer, it can be converted into an image. So here's the image shown with electrons, and here's that same image shown with ions. And it's very interesting that we can see in with both ways. And you can see in this particular example, the ions used were helium ions. So the way this works is you have a source of the gas you're going to use. You convert it into ions. You shoot it down on the surface. Here's your little specimen that you're trying to look at. As we know, it can be very, very, very small because this is so small. And we can look at with quotes around look, quotation marks around the word look, we can see the feature with ions. In this case, we have an electron detector and an ion detector. We can see it with ions, and we can then convert that with the efforts of a computer programmer into a display that we can see with our eyes. So that's what we see here. So we can see. I like to put quotes around that. Just like we can see with Braille, here we're seeing with a beam of ions. Chemical detection, we can do chemical detection with photons. And a common technique is called photoelectron spectroscopy, PES. It uses the energy of electrons emitted from a surface bombardment by photons for chemical characterization of a surface. We'll talk more about this in the next lecture, but the idea is that you have a sample, you shoot photons in. As you know, there's different energy levels in the sample. So you're shooting photons in, electrons come out, and you can use those electrons to figure out what the chemistry of the sample is. In other words, those electrons contain information about the energy levels. Energy levels are a function of what particular element you're looking at and the bonding, so you can use this photo-generated electron to get information about the material. So we can use photons to chemically characterize, very, very different than the nose or the taste buds. Depending on the photons used for the bombardment, this particular technique can be called UPS, ultraviolet photoelectron spectroscopy, or X-ray photoelectron spectroscopy, XPS. And folks doing characterization love to use all these different acronyms. I wanted to just mention, I've used the term microscopy, spectroscopy. These particular techniques are called spectroscopies because they require measuring the energies of the emitted electrons to get the information. So you just don't... See, in this case, all we had to do was collect the ions to generate the image. But here we have to actually measure the energies, that is what we convert into the chemical information. So we call that a spectroscopy. Microscopy allows us to see, create an image. Spectroscopy allows us to get more detailed information, such as chemical constituents that are present, the chemical constituents that are present. So with spectroscopies, we have to measure something. Use the energy. We can also do chemical detecting with photons in other ways, but I want to just stay with this photoelectron spectroscopy idea for a minute. As you see, it's the light coming in and the electrons coming out. We determine the energy information of those electrons, and therefore we work back to figure out what the sample was like. To make sure that we are not measuring chemically detecting inadvertently present contaminants, we use an ultra-high vacuum chamber. In this particular case, you recognize this is XPS. The photons coming in to excite the photoelectrons are X-rays. We can do chemical analysis with electrons. We can shoot a beam of electrons into a surface to knock off other electrons. Once again, the electrons that are knocked off contain information, carry information about the environment in which they resided inside the solid. They contain information about the bonding, the energy levels, and that can be extracted. So the electrons coming out can carry information about their atomic states. And this is called, those are called OJ electrons. In other words, an electron comes in, knocks an electron out. Well, actually, what usually happens is what's shown here. An electron comes in. This is the process that usually takes place. Electron comes in, excites an electron up to let's say up here, the electron was here, went to here, the electron falls back down, gives its energy to another electron. This is called the Auger electron. This is a French word, so it's pronounced Auger. And that electron coming out contains information about the levels in the atom That kind of information can then be extracted. Here's an energy band kind of picture where you see this electron's been, an electron here has been excited up to here. The electron relaxes and gives energy to another electron, which contains chemical information. The bottom line is that when you measure these electrons that come off, remember, electrons in, Auger electron out, and this electron contains chemical information about the solid that was impacted by the electrons. When you measure this, and here we see that shown, that measuring shown or plotted, you're measuring the kinetic energy in this case of the electrons coming off the Auger electrons. This is the information about the Auger electrons, and you see peaks at certain places. And this has been studied very, very well for, I guess, about this point, almost 40 years, I guess, that when you see these peaks at these certain energies, you know that's sodium, or nitrogen, I'm sorry. When you see it at this peak, you know that's copper, and you can pick up information about the bonding. So you can see how you can get chemical analysis information. So this is called Auger spectroscopy. Again, it's a spectroscopy because you do measuring. You're not imaging. You can do the same sorts of things with ions. So you can learn more at the nanoscale. So you can use a beam of ions to knock off and ionize constituent atoms of a solid. So then you have ions coming off. So in other words, you have a beam coming in, you hit a surface, you knock ions off, and then you can get chemical composition. In this case, you don't have to analyze the energy information of the as you did here with the electrons. In this case, the ions are knocked off, and you just know what they are because what ion? You know, if you knock off nitrogen, then you know it was nitrogen. If you knock off copper, then you know it was copper. You don't have to do this sort of analysis in this particular case. So you usually have high energy ions coming in. They sputter off, and sputtering is when you hit a surface and you just knock things off. So these incoming ions, they're high energy, sputter off and ionize some of the atoms. These secondary ions, these are the primary ions, the ones coming off of the secondary ions, are collected. You use mass analysis. Going through, this is a magnet, and there's a charge divided by mass separates the different ions. They come in different orbits going through that, different trajectories as they go through a racetrack like that with the magnets. You can then detect what ions are coming through by where they appear after they go through this racetrack, and therefore you know the chemical composition. This technique is called SIMD, secondary ion mass spectroscopy. And of course, this is spectroscopy. You're not getting an image, you're getting detailed information about the chemical composition. Now, we can actually use hearing, if I can generalize the word hearing. We can use the acoustic microscopy at the nanoscale, where we use sound waves to visualize structures too small to be resolved by the human eye. So we're going to use microscopy to see things. Of course, we're going to need our computer programmer in again. But what we can do is we can send in sound waves with frequencies up to several gigahertz in a setup we call an acoustic microscope. So we're going to see here. So this is a microscope, and we can send the acoustic waves down to the surface. So this transducer generates the waves. The waves go down, So this is the path coming in. This is obviously ultrasound. If you go back and look at our acoustic spectrum, so this is very high frequency ultrasound. And so we can actually detect grain boundaries with this. And here you can see nuclei of cells, and then you can actually see the nucleoli inside the nuclei. So this is a very interesting technique, allowing you to look at things where you could not use ion beams or don't want to use electrons because they could damage a sample. You can use sound waves here to see. And you can get down to several hundred nanometers. So you're just coming to the fringe of the nano range. We're able to see here with the acoustic microscope. In subsequent lectures, we're going to look more deeply into nanoscale characterization. Obviously, that's our objective in the course, nanoscale characterization and testing. And when we're discussing characterization, we're going to look more deeply into nanoscale techniques. Obviously, though, with this introduction, you can see that we can use a lot of innovative approaches to be able to see, touch, chemically analyze, and hear at the nanoscale. Very, very creative techniques. So to summarize the lecture, we've talked about characterization and the use of touch, sight, chemical assessment, and sound. And we've talked about that in the beginning of the lecture. We talked about those ways of characterizing at our scale, the nanoscale, the inch, the foot, the mile, the 10 miles, the 1,000 miles kind of scale. And then we talked about it in the latter part of the lecture, using these approaches to characterization at the nanoscale. And we did a quick introduction to touching at the nanoscale. We looked at seeing at the nanoscale, and we looked at chemical detecting at the nanoscale, and we looked at hearing at the nanoscale. And I think we have to put, again, I put quotes around this because we don't want to think of fingers anymore. We want to think of probes in general. And seeing, we don't want to think of the eye anymore. We want to think of maybe probes, maybe ions, maybe electrons, maybe photons. And chemical detecting, we certainly don't want to think of taste and smell anymore. We want to think of it may be a beam of ions that we're using. It may be of photons. It may be electrons that we're using to do chemical detection. And hearing, it's certainly not acoustics in our range. We can use acoustic vibrations that are much more energetic, but we can use them to hear at the nanoscale. We can use that hearing, and we can use that touching, and we can use that seeing. In all these cases, we can use these things to make images, or in some of these technologies, we can use them to create spectroscopies. In which case, we can deduce information such as chemical bonding, energies, things of that sort. So we have some powerful approaches that have been developed so that we can characterize the nanoscale. And that characterization has allowed us to proceed at the nanoscale, constantly developing the technology even better because we know the Romans worked at the nanoscale. There's the Lycurgus cup, which is nanoparticles in glass. But the Romans could never characterize what they were doing. They didn't have the techniques. Today we can characterize at the nanoscale. We can see what we're doing, and we can improve what we're doing.